Let's be honest. Buying cannabis shouldn't be complicated, sketchy, or low quality. That's why I want to tell you about Mood.com. That's Mood.com. Mood ships federally legal cannabis straight to your door. No medical card, no hassle. And here's the kicker. The quality is better than anything you'll find at your local dispensary. Yeah, I said it. Whether you're into edibles, concentrates, flower, or just looking to explore, you'll find it all at Mood. And it's not just the variety that makes them stand out. Every product is sourced from small, American-owned family farms that care deeply about what they grow. It's cannabis you can trust, delivered discreetly, and ready to elevate your mood. And because you're a listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just head to Mood.com. That's Mood.com to get started.
All right, buongiorno. I am back from Italy. Others receiving votes. We got the band pretty much back together here. Myself, Pat Forty, joined by Brian Fisher and Kevin Sweeney. I'm sure you all have checked the calendar. You know it's March. That means we're going to talk a lot of basketball. One of the best months of the year. Tournament basketball starts today, Monday, March 2nd. And it ain't stopping till sometime in April. So this is going to be a really fun few weeks. It always is. We're going to get in touch with March Madness here. I want to lead off with a little bit of madness, a little anger, guys. Saturday night in the O-Dome in Gainesville, Florida beating the absolute brakes off of Arkansas. And in the middle of that, John Calipari and Todd Golden looked like they're ready to throw down. They were screaming at each other, F-bombing each other. Both got teed up. There was some hold me back stuff, but I wanted to see him go at it personally. I thought that would have been enjoyable. John Calipari has one of history's most famous coach confrontations when John Chaney from Temple went in and threatened to kill him after a game when Cal was at UMass back in the 90s. People got in between them then, or that really might have been an episode of coach-on-coach violence. We've had some other dust-ups. Rick Pitino once went nose-to-chest with John Thompson in the Big Ten days. But I'm curious. It would have been interesting if these two had actually gotten to go at it. Golden in his 30s, Cal in his 60s. I don't know whether it would have been a fair fight. But if we could have two coaches enter the octagon, guys, if you could pick your coach fight, it's easier maybe in football, but in basketball, who would you want to see duke it out? Brian.
Well, I love, you know, you're almost straight off the plane and a couple of days removed from Italy, and you're like right into coach fights. Absolutely. Immediately jumping into the podcast. You know, this one was an interesting one. I was kind of thinking, like, you know, who's kind of like, you know, got the look of a fighter, you know, like maybe TJ Otzelberger at Iowa State. You know, he's just got that neck too that you would think of being a fighter. I was kind of thinking maybe we've probably seen this before, at least their dad has, you know, like Dan versus Bobby Hurley, you know, kind of get the brothers fighting. You know, that could be a bit of an interesting one. And really the one thing that came to mind too, as soon as you sent this question over, was Kevin Willard had some, choice comments about his time working for Rick Pitino. So maybe those two going against each other were a good one. But the one that I came up with was Nate Oates, since I don't think the coaching community necessarily is all in on Nate Oates after the Charles Bediako thing and everything that he pulled, although they can probably understand where he's coming from on that. But him versus Frank Martin, I think Frank Martin can take just about anybody out there, just given what his background and what he brings to the table. So I'm going to go Nate Oates versus Frank Martin.
I'd pay for that. I'd pay the pay-per-view. Bring it on.
Yeah. I love any Frank Martin fight, and I will be backing Frank in that exactly. War, even as he gets up there in age. I do just appreciate generally some of these younger coaches walking into the hornet's nest and not being afraid to scrum it up. Right. I remember when Todd Golden got the job at Florida, I think that was the real question, was like, man, like Calipari, Rick Barnes, Bruce Pearl, like, is this guy ready to like swim with the sharks? And I think one of the reasons he has been successful is that he, is not running from the smoke in any sense. And I think, obviously, it helps to have the national championship now in your pocket. But even from year one, I've always felt like Todd was not running from the fight. And I think someone who's maybe similarly situated right now is Dusty May at Michigan, who you wouldn't think of as a fighter and probably wouldn't consider himself one. But the sense I've gotten is that perhaps the coaches in the Big Ten are maybe not so pleased with Dusty and especially some of the old guard. We saw the Tom Izzo comments after Dusty called out Jeremy Fears. Obviously, Dusty has been, let's call it an aggressive roster builder, which some people have not enjoyed. So, I mean, the Michigan-Michigan State rivalry is good enough as it is. But if we could get a couple of short guys and Dusty and Izzo face to face, I would certainly take that either this year or down the road.
That would be something. Now, that would also be a major age differential fight, but I would not put anything past a youper hard ass like Tom Izzo. I mean, age 70, you'd be like, come on, let's go. I don't know. I love it. I've got a few suggestions. Some of you read my mind a little bit there. Brian, a Suns Out, Guns Out fight between TJ Otzelberger and Damon Stoudemire. Two yoked up dudes that wear the Schmedium shirts on the sideline. Stoudemire needs a win of some kind. Maybe he could take down Otzelberger there. Dan Hurley versus anybody and everybody. If it's Bobby, that's fine, but I think he'd be ready to go with anyone. Mark Madsen versus Dwayne Stevens. I got to look at Dwayne Stevens for the first time in a while. When I was watching Miami against Western Michigan, those are big guys. Madsen was an NBA power forward. Yeah.
Maybe some flailing on that one.
Madsen played like a wild man. Just give me somebody to run into. So he would fit there. excuse me. But I really would like to see the LA bantamweight matchup. Mick Cronin versus Eric Musselman. Both, checking in at about 145 pounds, but fists of fury, I guarantee it. Plenty of general fury there. Musselman used to take off his shirt when they won games at Arkansas. So I think there would be a lot of bravado there, a lot of surliness. So just some potential, some March daydreaming there. Cause we could always use a good coach fight, right? Let's bring that on. One more fighting topic I want to hit before we get to a main topic here. The Miami, Ohio Redhawks are creating fights all over the place on social media, among the punditocracy, people who put together brackets. They're 29-0. Their resume is not stout, but they're 29-0. And if they don't win the MAC championship, there's a lot of discussion whether they should get an at-large bid. Bruce Pearl, certainly a neutral observer, his son Steven at Auburn on the bubble, says no, they don't belong in the tournament at large. Kevin, you do our bracket watch for us. They're playing Toledo Tuesday and they're playing Ohio, two pretty good MAC teams. If they lose one of those, are they must win in the MAC tournament to get in the field?
I don't think they're must win, but I think they would probably feel better if they could at least get to a championship game against Akron. Because if you do that, it wouldn't be a bad loss. Akron's a very good team. Akron is, we talk about like Cinderella potential and who are like Akron is flying so under the radar because of the Miami story. They're really, really good too. They're, I think, 57th in the net. So, look, with where they stand right now, Miami's quote unquote resume metrics are really strong. They're 34th in total resume average. They have a 32 in the wins above bubble that everybody's gung-ho about these days. Even if they lost twice, I would imagine that that Miami's wins above bubble would probably be in the mid-40s, and that would put them probably headed to Dayton in the first four. So I think it's an instance where both people are technically right. Right. Like Bruce Pearl's argument at its core was Miami is not one of the best teams in the country. And analytically, like that's correct. Right. Like you go back and you look at like Murray State. When Murray State went, it was a one loss team entering the NCAA tournament. Murray State had like real wins and I think was top 40 in most of the like predictive analytics. The predictives were pretty confident this was a good team. Miami is sort of like your standard 12-13 seed profile. They just happen to win all the games. unfortunately, like winning all the games is a pretty key part of this process, right? Like if we wanted to just build a preseason, if we just wanted to put in the predictive metrics and say, hey, well, KenPom says Auburn's really good, even though they lose every time they play. Great, right? Like that wouldn't be a very fun tournament for me to watch. I don't think it'd be a lot of fun for others. So I do think Miami has earned their at-large bid, even if they are probably not an at-large caliber team. And I think that to me is probably where the argument ends. But at the same time, you know, lose two games this week, one bad week, and all of a sudden things get real dicey for the Redhawks.
Well, and aren't we all prepared for this to be some sort of test case about tournament expansion? And you leave out Miami of Ohio, you know, in a couple of weeks on Selection Sunday, and then there's the ammunition for everybody that wants to expand the tournament, even though that is a terrible idea. And, you know, frankly, I mean, this is kind of going back with the Redhawks in particular, kind of going back to our conversation with Travis Steele last week. This is a veteran team. This is a team you don't want to see in that tournament kind of setting because you know they've played together. They know in those crunch time situations, when that clock is counting down in the tournament and you kind of got the crowd on, probably going to be, the adopted team of everybody, all the non-neutrals that end up in whatever sub-regional they're at, everybody's going to be rooting for Miami, Ohio, right? Yeah, and so that if you're an opposing coach, of course you don't want to see this team. You know, veteran guards, guys that know how to win, pull out games like they did, the other night to remain undefeated. Like that's the team you don't want to see, even if they are a 12 or 13 seed or even further down on the bubble. So to me, this is a case of maybe some of the coaches out there are saying, hey, get them out of the tournament or at least send them to Dayton, worst case. You know, we don't want to play them in one of those opening rounds, especially given how, a lot of these teams that might be on the opposing sidelines, right? Playing a couple of freshmen probably haven't had that experience necessarily of March Madness and those bright lights. So, I can understand, from that standpoint, coaches saying, hey, I don't want this team in the tournament if they lose a game. But I think they're a great story and they've earned it. Like Kevin, you were saying, I mean, that winning all the games and even dropping one or two here down the stretch. I mean, it doesn't take away from the way that they've won games. And yes, you could slice and dice the competition and the resume and all that. But I think this is a team that has earned that bid to the tournament, regardless of what happens there in Cleveland for the MAC tournament or down the stretch here in the regular season.
It just strikes me. Sorry, Pat. It just strikes me that like, for the good of the enterprise, Miami, by winning all the games, needs to be in the tournament. Because what message are we sending if not, right? I think it already feels as though college basketball for most of Division I is a series of exhibitions until you get to the conference tournament, right? That becomes entirely true for 275 out of 365. If you say, who cares, Miami? You went 30-1. You don't get to make the NCAA. Like at some point, that would be the message. It does not matter how many games you win. If you are not in a power conference or you are not at least in a elite mid-major league, right? You know, the A-10, which has become largely a one-bid league in many seasons, the Mountain West, which is struggling this year to get over the hump, the WCC, which will get, two, maybe three, but that includes Gonzaga, who's its own sort of entity. Like they've already been essentially boxed out of the mix. If this isn't enough, then nothing will ever be enough. And so at that point, what's even the point? Like let's skip over the games and let's play the conference tournament that everybody seems to love that makes the conference office a little bit of money. And that's that. Like I just think it's important for the state of the sport that winning be rewarded.
If Miami ends up sitting there 30-2 or 30-whatever and doesn't get in, I'll lead the riot, right? I will drive up I-65 to Indy and lead the flippin' riot, because to your point, winning has to matter. And that has to be a major metric. And I don't care about the other metrics. If you're 29-0 right now, you're doing a lot of things right. Coaches talk all the time. It's hard. It's hard. Winning's hard. And then what do they say next? Winning on the road is the hardest thing. Miami is 13-0 on the road. Auburn's 2-7, Indiana's 3-7, SMU's 3-7, Iowa's 3-7 on the road. If those teams get in ahead of Miami, I'm going to be really displeased. To your point, yes, the sport is supposed to reward doing what Miami has done. Secondarily, their schedule is not good. Their non-conference schedule is not good. Guess what? It's really hard to schedule non-conference right now for mid-major teams. It is very difficult. For the most part, It's you're not going to get games from high majors. You're sure as heck not going to get them on your home court. You're probably not going to get them on a neutral court because they want to play other big-time opponents. And so we've seen this general box out, I think, of a lot of the mid-majors from even getting a chance to play power conference opponents. If you look, there's fewer and fewer games between those A-10 teams and MAC and Missouri Valley and so on and so forth against the power conference teams. They don't get the chances to beat them. Whereas, you know, the SEC and Big Ten and Big 12 and ACC teams get chance after chance after chance after chance to lose and lose and lose and lose and still be able to make the tournament. So, yeah, they have some good wins, but they have a lot of losses. They get a lot of chances. The MAC, you don't get those chances. And so they're playing right now with a lot of weight, I think, on their shoulders at Miami. I mean, that looked like a team that was feeling it at Western Michigan Friday night. And the fact that they won with starting guard Luke Skaljak out with a hand wrist injury and their best player, Peter Suter, fouling out, and they're down 9 in the second half, and they came back and won. I don't care what Western Michigan's record is. You take any coach in any league and you win a road game in those circumstances without two of your guards when you're behind by 9 points in the second half, you're going to walk out and say, that is a great win. So I don't want to hear people saying, oh, you barely beat a terrible team. I watched the game. The fact they won was impressive. So I think the Miami of Ohio debate will continue. Again, they play Toledo on Tuesday at home. Then they play at Ohio on Friday, and then it is on to MACtion. And this will be one of the most watched MAC tournaments I think we've probably ever had. So we'll keep an eye on that. But now let's talk about the top of the food chain, guys.
Do you feel too full after meals like your digestion could use a little support? Try Bitterex from Quiksilver Scientific. Bitterex is a blend of botanical bitter extracts designed to support healthy digestion and your body's natural digestive processes. Bitter herbs have been used for centuries to support digestive function, helping stimulate digestive activity. Just a few pumps before meals make Quiksilver Scientific's Bitterex easy to add to your routine. Get 10% off and free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast for 10% off and free shipping. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Let's be honest. Buying cannabis shouldn't be complicated, sketchy, or low quality. That's why I want to tell you about Mood.com. That's MOOD.com. Mood ships federally legal cannabis straight to your door. No medical card, no hassle. And here's the kicker. The quality is better than anything you'll find at your local dispensary. Yeah, I said it. Whether you're into edibles, concentrates, flower, or just looking to explore, you'll find it all at Mood. And it's not just the variety that makes them stand out. Every product is sourced from small, American-owned family farms that care deeply about what they grow. It's cannabis you can trust, delivered discreetly, and ready to elevate your mood. And because you're a listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just head to Mood.com. That's MOOD.com to get started.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.
It was a flex weekend for a lot of the teams that we already thought were good and now look maybe even better, like they're separating from the pack. I've got 5 teams that are ahead of everyone else right now, which I like, and I'll explain why. And then you guys can tell me what you think and what we're going to do. We're going to rank them. Everybody's going to do their own top 5 with these. Or if you've got somebody else you think is better and should be in the top 5, fire away. But the 5, Duke, 27-2, number 1 in KenPom, number 1 in the polls, destroyed Virginia. We've got an ACC team. Michigan, 27-2, number 2 in the KenPom, number 3 in the polls, blew out Illinois on the road. We've got a Big Ten team. Arizona, 27-2, number 3 in KenPom in the polls, beat down Kansas. We've got a Big 12 team. Florida, 23-6, coming on like a freight train, as I mentioned, destroyed Arkansas beat them by 34 points. John Calipari's worst SEC loss. We've got an SEC team. And Connecticut, 27-3, number 10 in KenPom, but number 6 in the polls. By the way, these polls are as of Monday morning. They'll change later today. Coming off a close shave against Seton Hall, but before that, they destroyed St. John's. We've got regional diversity. We have conference diversity. We have big names. I think this is awesome for the game. I think this is going to be really great in terms of high interest going into March or into the postseason here. But for right now, guys, tell me how you would rank these five. Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, number one, I think you're right that it's a great group. I think it's also those are the five. I think, you know, the Iowa States, the Houstons, the Illinois that have hung around this conversation have started to separate themselves maybe in a negative way, and or these five have just been so good. I would take Michigan number one. I know that that's, you know, eschewing the head-to-head result with Duke, and Duke has been unbelievably impressive. I still think the best version of Michigan is the best team in the country and one of the better teams we have seen over the last several years, just in terms of, you know, the way they like there's no team I think of that's better at stepping on your throat than Michigan. Like it goes really fast and you don't have a whole lot of control of it. The size, the physicality, the rim protection with Mara, I would take them over Duke, but it's very close. Those would be my top two. Number three, I have Florida over Arizona right now. Florida, Arizona, 3-4. Man, has Florida turned a corner, right? And you knew, like, if their guards could get going at all, it would be really scary because of the size. But it's not just that Boogie Flan's playing well and Xavier Lee's playing well and that the bench has given them something. Alex Condon, the last 3 weeks, has been absolutely phenomenal, right? And he's the one who bore the, you know, brunt of the expectation. He was the preseason first-team All-American from Florida. And I always felt like whoever got the label in the preseason for Florida was going to maybe struggle to deal with that because the other guys are so good too. And Condon has just turned a corner to where, man, like you have him flying around and playing great offensively, like he's elevated. And then Hauk is phenomenal. And Chinyelu, you could argue, should be SEC player of the year because he's so good defensively and on the glass. So they just have a lot of ways to beat you. They punked Arkansas out. That was very impressive to me. I would take them just ahead of Arizona, who I think is phenomenal. I think they're a little more overwhelming at the moment. And then UConn is still UConn, right? I think they're tough to deal with in a tournament setting because of the way that they play offense. They're hard to prepare for. It does feel like they don't maybe have the killer instinct that they had in their championship runs. They have played with their food in Big East play more often than I would like, but still a really good team. And we saw what it looks like when they are really good against St. John's earlier in the week.
Yeah, I'm going to go reverse order here just to kind of combat some of Kevin's talking points, because we do diversify the opinion just a little bit. And you know, speaking of the Huskies, you're right. The playing with the food thing is the thing that kind of gets me and says there's an ultimate ceiling, you know, with this team. And I will give credit, you know, that they've got a coach who obviously knows how to, you know, kind of massage these tournament runs and get deep into the tournament and knows that kind of rhythm that you're going to see in March. And you know, that is definitely a factor in them. And they can, when they're hot, I think they can shoot the lights out and pose a lot of difficult matchup problems. Just the way they can have a guy go off that, you know, you're not even expecting at times sometimes for, you know, 15, 20 points. But I'm curious about the focus, and maybe that's just state of the Big East nowadays. You know, we'll certainly see as they get into March, new opponents. You know, you definitely saw a difference between how they were playing early in the year in the non-conference compared to what they've done in the Big East play. It just seems like, you know, they're almost waiting for March. So I don't know if that's a good thing, if they can kind of flip that switch. But, you know, I do give Hurley and company, you know, a lot of credit in terms of how they've built this roster, how they can play a couple of different styles. And I think this is a dangerous team, but I'm just not sure they're really truly that upper tier kind of elite team compared to the other four, at least. And I would have Florida at four. I think maybe it's just they are hitting their stride at the right time, but I think certainly early in the season, you know, maybe it's the outside shooting, you know, when that is going to be the game plan, you know, certainly against the Gators is, you know, force them. I would imagine, you know, during the tournament, they're going to get a lot of different zone looks, you know, I'm sure to kind of see what they can do, hopefully kind of slow them down a little bit. I'm going to be very curious to see, You know, Todd Golden has had all the answers certainly last year. And I think there's going to be kind of, you know, he talked, you know, early last season about talking to Billy Donovan about defending the title and how this team is going to be hungry to do that. I think that is in their favor. I'm just kind of going to be curious, you know, if that outside shot doesn't start falling like it's been the last couple of weeks, if they can kind of get over the hump against one of those other elite teams. But I think they are looking pretty good, depending on kind of the matchups to get there to Indianapolis. I'm going to have Duke at number three. I understand all the metrics. I understand all the focus on the Blue Devils, and it's been a terrific job for John Shire after what happened last season, after what he lost last season, and probably two of the favorites in the NBA Rookie of the Year to regroup with this group. You know, certainly Boozer is running away with Player of the Year, and his ability, you know, I think to be able to, all right, let's just go to him for a couple of touches. You know, just if there's a scoreless run that the Blue Devils are on, you know, you go 2 or 3 minutes without scoring, you can just dump it down into him. He can get a load. He's splitting double teams and making it look effortless. That's going to be a huge asset in March, but I'm just not sure in terms of the kind of playmakers around him. You know, if you are throwing double, triple teams, can those other guys hit the outside shot? So I think that's maybe capping Duke's ceiling a little bit. I still think they can win it all, but I think if you're comparing them to the other teams, I think Arizona, the way that they, you know, you got Crevis at the rim, you got you know, so many guys that you can throw out on the perimeter. They can match up so many different ways with you. I think Tommy Lloyd has understood this team better than some of the previous additions that he's had there in Tucson. And I think playing in the Big 12, you know, where you're going to go up against different styles, you're going to play against, you know, Houston, you're going to go up against Iowa State, you're going to go up against Kansas and try to defend Peterson. You're going to be exposed to, I think, a lot of different things that I think can translate better in March for this Arizona team. And then I'll have Michigan number one. I think we'll see, certainly with, you know, losing LJ Kason with the ACL injuries, how that affects their rotation moving forward. But I think Michigan, you know, the way they do kind of go for that kill shot, you know, I think that is special. I think they are kind of the favorite going into March Madness. I think they're going to be well prepared coming out of the Big Ten. And, you know, frankly, this kind of just shaping up to be the year of the Big Ten, right? You know, in terms of everything that's going on around that conference, to get over that hump for the first time since Michigan State back in 2000. It, you know, that Final Four was in Indianapolis. It's in Indianapolis this year. Again, maybe things are just kind of lining up for Michigan. I think having the veteran coach in Dusty May, who knows how to get to the Final Four, having the guys that are hungry, having the guys that are just tough matchups, you know, going against Mara. I mean, that's somebody that, you know, for those first couple of rounds, nobody's going to be able to defend him as long as he stays out of foul trouble. So I still think Michigan's the favorite, but it's a very compelling year because there is, you know, really you can make the case for all five of these teams cutting down the nets there in Indy.
You can absolutely make the case for all five, I think. Unfortunately, my ranking is exactly like Kevin's. I got Michigan 1, Duke 2, Florida 3, Arizona 4, UConn 5. I even have Florida pushing on Duke a little bit there. Maybe I was a little too smitten by what I saw from them Saturday night, but knowing what I know about how they did last year and you know, that once you get a coach who has that full confidence in how to handle a tournament, that impresses me. The other cool thing about this group, other than five different conferences represented in five different regions of the country, well, this is the next generation of great coaches, right? I mean, think of all of the hand-wringing that went on with, oh, my God, we've lost Jay Wright, we've lost Kay, we've lost Roy, we've lost Boeheim. They're all great coaches. I take nothing away from them. But there was almost this feeling like we don't have a next generation coming along. Oh, yes, we do. Yes, we do. The game's in great hands. None of these guys, they're all under 55 years old. Shire and Golden in their 30s. Hurley and Lloyd in their 50s. Dusty May in his late 40s. They're in their primes right now. So I think that is another healthy sign for where this thing is going. You know, there's going to be some upsets. One, obviously, look, five teams, they can't all make the Final Four. Probably four of them can't make the Final Four. There's going to be some stuff that's going to happen. We won't be able to really even conjecture on that until we see brackets. But I am just very excited about the stretch run in the sport and this many compelling, really good teams representing this many parts of the country. So looking forward to seeing how this plays out. One negative element to what's going on this season. I wrote about this in the 40 Minutes this week. The Big East is sinking when a lot of people thought it was going to soar. The Big East right now is a three-bid league, and I don't see that changing unless somebody else wins the conference tournament other than UConn, St. John's, or Villanova. So this really is actually – that would be tie their fewest number of NCAA bids ever. Outside of UConn, meh. St. John's has been a bit of a disappointment. Villanova's probably done a little better than expected, but that's it. And then everybody else does not matter. So I want to go back last summer and even the summer before that, 2024, to all of the people that were absolutely losing their mind saying the Big East was going to have an unfair advantage because of House versus NCAA revenue sharing. Quotes, there was a great quote from Nate Oates, you know, this is a problem. This is going to be unfair. First of all, everybody gets to spend their money the way they want, right? But secondly, his point was that if everybody has $20.5 million and the Big East doesn't have to spend any on football, they can spend it all on basketball. Well, we're spending most of our money on football at our schools. The problem there being, this was never going to stop at $20.5 million. We're up to $40 million, $50 million, and schools that care even a little bit about basketball are going to fund their basketball. And the basketball schools, the other part that people just never really computed, they don't all have $20 million sitting around. Xavier doesn't have $20 million. Butler doesn't have $20 million. Marquette doesn't have $20 million. They may have half of that. And so if you're spending 10% of your $40 million or $45 million, let's say, on basketball at an SEC school, and you're spending 90% of your $10 million at a Big East school, guess what? It's about the same. The other element here is that some Big East schools have invested poorly, right? St. John's roster has not performed. Providence's roster has not performed. So I find it humorous that as is so often the case in college sports, there was a subset of people screaming from the highest yard arms, my God, this is unfair. Somebody's going to get an advantage. And it isn't true. Now, is it going to change? Kevin, you tell me, is the Big East eventually going to get it together and dominate college basketball?
I don't think it's going to dominate. I mean, look, I was a little surprised as I've talked to more coaches around the country about what schools are preparing to spend this spring. I think there was a feeling that last year was a gold rush and this is the last chance we can front load all this cash ahead of the settlement. And you know, you'd call coaches in the fall and they'd be like, man, it's so unsustainable that we just spent $12 million on a roster. Next year, it's going to have to come back to the pack. And so I think you could sort of spin this narrative, man, like if these Big East schools are ready to spend, they don't have to deal with the cap. They don't have to navigate the CSC. All right, maybe long term the Big East can take advantage of this. Meanwhile, I get phone calls every day of like, yeah, Rutgers is ready to spend $8 to $10 million on a basketball roster. South Carolina is ready to spend close to $10 million on a basketball roster. No one is ready to lose the arms race, and quite frankly, the Big East doesn't have the arms. If they want to spend $10 million, they got to go raise it big time, because these schools don't make enough revenue. You know, not that the SEC and them are not calling their donors. Of course they are. But they were never going to go down without a fight. So I do expect the Big East to continue to invest. I think Xavier will be closer to that $10 million mark than they were this year. Providence spent big, plans to seemingly continue. Creighton, I think, will invest. Marquette has the money. And it seems Shaka is ready to work the portal in some form. So I'm not necessarily fading the Big East into the future. And I think a lot of this year's struggles are, as you said, poor investments, coaches that looked good on paper, not working out, et cetera, et cetera. But I do not think that the Big East is poised to take things over unless there is a much stronger enforcement arm from the CSC than anyone is anticipating. And I will say, as I call coaches and I say, hey, how much do you plan to spend? And they say $8 million, $10 million, $12 million, whatever. And I ask, well, how do you plan to do that? There are often no real answers, even at schools where the football team just spent well over the cap and would theoretically have answers. So That was okay, I suppose, in January. It is now March. Contracts are going out. We're a month away from the portal opening. There is still a lot of uncertainty, but one coach referred to it that they have, quote, plenty of access to capital, which made them sound a bit like a investment guy. But either way, the investment folks are ready to spend as long as they can find a way to justify it.
Well, you know, you speak to the dichotomy between the external narrative, which was coming from other parts of the country, right? You know, it was coming from the SEC and the ACC. Oh, how are you know, and honestly, that was kind of a call to arms, you know, to their own donors, to their own administrators to say, hey, they're going to spend this. We got to spend this. So, you know, I think there was that kind of aspect of almost marketing, you know, from some of those external programs. And then from the conversations I had, certainly with you know, Big East ADs and other administrators in the league, there was to the point, I think, Kevin, you made, like, they also had to raise that money. Like, it was not just kind of sitting there, oh, here's $20.5 million to spend on one roster. Now, a lot of those Big East programs also wanted to spend in a couple other sports here and there that they were good at. So there was that aspect of things. But yeah, I don't think any Big East program necessarily was coming close to allotting that full $20.5 million just in revenue sharing, not even talking about some of the external NIL deals that they could facilitate, that sort of thing. So, yeah, there's a bit of a raising money thing in the Big East. I think, you know, you're right in terms of just the total miss on some of these coaches about, number one, what that ultimate number would be to spend on a roster, who it's spending on, you know, like the miss evaluations from some of these rosters in the Big East. Like, that was probably the biggest root of the problem this year in particular. You know, like, you look at some of their bench options, you know, like, it doesn't even compare to what some of those SEC or ACC programs have been able to get, not only in terms of the evaluation, but what they're also actually paying, you know, in terms of getting that return on the investment. So, you know, yes, maybe long term, you're not necessarily shying away, because you can definitely see maybe down the road where, yes, a UConn is allotting $20 million to their roster. And you know what? In the SEC, yeah, you're not going to come anywhere close to that. But, you know, there's only five players that take the court at the same time. And a lot of this does come down to coaching, into the development, into that roster, how you're managing things and getting guys on the court. So, you know, there's a lot of factors at play. I think the Big East will be fine. I think they will kind of understand things, but they were kind of ill-prepared. And I think truly, you know, you talk with some of their administrators, like, I think opening up the wallets a little bit, you know, is a little bit more difficult at some of these Big East schools, because a lot of those donors, they want proof positive. Like, if I'm going to cut the check for, you know, $1 million player in the Big East, I want to be able to see that, all right, that's actually a wise donation, you know, and I don't think they really kind of had that proof. Not only this year, but going back the last couple of years, as NIL, as the transfer portal has come into vogue, they haven't had that proof positive. So it's even more difficult to raise those dollars that go directly towards that roster. And I think everybody's kind of coming around to some of those changes in college athletics that could theoretically allow the Big East to kind of take advantage of things.
Yeah. Last point on this, just the other thing that intrinsically the schools that don't have football money are just not used to lavish big swings of investment. They're, you know, that they've not ever been wired that way. Whereas if you're in the SEC, Big Ten, elsewhere, that's a day-to-day way of living. It's like, we've got to build 19 million facilities and they've got to all be phenomenal. And we've got to pay a shit ton for a strength coach and a defensive coordinator and offensive coordinator. So that kind of translates pretty easily to basketball as well. In the Big East, I mean, these are largely smaller Catholic or private schools that don't think that way. They've never thought that way athletically. And so I think it's taking a bit of a changing of the mindset. UConn did, but UConn is the outlier there. And UConn's also won 6 national championships or whatever, you know, in the last 26 years. So it's just, I think, a mindset that needs to evolve as well. All right, last basketball thing here. We are going to get to some football. Please stay with us, people. But this is, as I mentioned at the beginning, the Little Dance Week. This is the mid-major tournaments. I love this week. They actually start Monday night. For those that are watching the YouTube version here, and please all watch the YouTube version because apparently that's important. I'm wearing a West Coast Conference hat representing the WCC. We will be paying attention to all the early league action. I picked all of the Little Dance tournaments this week in this week's 40 minutes. You can check that out. But I want you guys to give me one mid-major tournament that grabs your interest, one you're more excited about maybe than the others. Kevin?
I always love the Missouri Valley. I'm going to go down there for a couple days and get a lay of the land. It is very much sort of this like still pure conference tournament. They do a great job in that arena of sort of grouping up the fans by school, by section. Everybody buys out their section. It's a fun, rowdy atmosphere. The fans really get behind it. And it's great basketball. Belmont's phenomenal. If Belmont can win this tournament, even if they don't, I think they have a maybe small chance at an at-large. But if they can get in somehow, they're going to be really dangerous. But Illinois State and Bradley and Murray State and UIC are all pretty darn good. So I always look forward to the Valley. And that Sunday CBS conference championship does feel like in many ways the beginning of the race to Selection Sunday.
Absolutely. I'm going to go with the conference tournament we just kind of talked about in terms of the MAC. I mean, you got Akron out there, 15-1 in conference, 24-5 overall, definitely profiles very favorably in the tournament. The whole Miami of Ohio story. I mean, everybody loves a little bit of action. Plus it's a bit of a farewell, kind of for some of the members of the league, obviously, or the Illinois is leaving. They're obviously going to the Mountain West in football and to the Horizon and some of their other sports. You got new members coming in after this year. So like there's, a bit of a kind of an interesting vibe. I think they're around MAC. And I will also shout out the Mountain West because it's kind of the similar standpoint. Yes, you have Utah State kind of leading the way. Everybody looking at maybe Jared Calhoun if you're of interest in terms of needing a new coach. So there's that. Obviously, you have New Mexico, San Diego State's on the bubble as well. Just always an interesting time, for those conference tournaments. It's in Vegas. I think there's going to be some interest just in terms of that is going to be the last time some of these schools are all together, at once. They're in Vegas, given some are departing for the Pac-12, welcoming some other new members as well out there. First time for Grand Canyon to be there at Mountain West conference tournament. So I will shout out the Mountain West there, not just because I have a story on the conference coming out on SI.com later this week as well.
Please leave Utah State alone. Let them keep a coach for more than like 10 minutes. Jared Calhoun's a great coach, but they have been through it, man. 2021, Craig Smith. 2022 and 23, Ryan Odom. 2024, Danny Sprinkle. Now year two with Jared Calhoun. Good coaches. My gosh, the churn, though. I feel bad for Utah State and its fans. And have to... have to keep starting over the way that they have. And I especially for a school that once had as a mascot, a bull that they painted blue, and they used to bring him in for basketball games until his hooves started scuffing up the court and they had to try to fit him in boots. That didn't work out very well either. So, you got to try harder when you're at Utah State, but the tournament I am excited about, kind of almost irrationally excited about at this point, is the Sun Belt with my favorite bracket, the flock of Canadian geese bracket, where it's like 14 teams spread out across like 7 days. And they, they start playing, two games at a time, and everybody just advances, and the top two seeds only have to play two games. And then the top four seeds only have to play three and so forth. And you move it on down. So it really does give an advantage to the regular season best teams, which is great, except for this year when there's a 6-way tie for second place, which is an absolute train wreck of trying to figure out tiebreakers. And so it breaks down that like Arkansas State, which really actually may be the second best team in the league, or if you look at Ken Pomeroy, has the best Ken Pomeroy rating, finished one game out of first, but is the number 7 seed. And so they've got to play like forever to try to get the championship game. I think it'd be 5 games in 5 days or 6 games in 6 days, something ridiculous. And then if you look at the actual, you go into the actual teams, and it is the ties make sense because they all barely beat each other. Every game is a friggin' heart attack. Coastal Carolina, who I've settled on as the team to beat here. They are the number 3 seed. This is the margins of like their last 10 games. 5 points, 4 points, 4 points, 3 in triple OT, 4 points, 2 points, 4 points, 5 points, 1 point. So if you want to watch a tournament where every single game is going to probably go down to the wire and you're going to see whether somebody can somehow win like 5 games in 5 days, check out the Sun Belt. It should be a lot of fun. All right, I promise we're going to talk about something other than basketball, so let's get to that here. In case you haven't noticed, And I tried not to notice while I was in Italy, but it's hard because stuff keeps happening. The leaders of college sports are rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic again. We had a few developments last week. We had a white paper from a firm that was commissioned by the SEC and the Big Ten that shockingly found what those two leagues wanted it to find, that the SAVE Act, which would reform the way college sports revenue is paid out and broadcasting entities, scheduling, et cetera, and pooling broadcast media rights would not be good for college sports. That, of course, led to those championing the SAVE Act, notably Texas Tech mega booster Cody Campbell and others from places outside the SEC and the Big Ten, including the chairman of the Board of Trustees at Louisville, assailed the white paper findings, said they're flawed. And then right before he decided to start a war, Donald Trump commissioned a panel to find solutions for college sports. It'll include Tiger Woods for reasons nobody can quite figure out. We'll see if he gets around to having that. The last time he was going to have a panel, I think they ended up not having the panel. So anyway, Brian, you've been in the country. You're paying attention to this stuff. Can you please explain the latest flare-up and who out of these entities actually has the best interests of college sports at heart?
To answer that second question, I would say none of them necessarily. I think they're all very self-interested parties involved in this. And, you know, I wrote a column a couple weeks ago on SI.com just in terms of the strategy has to change. This is a failed strategy in terms of going to Washington, D.C., which we could all see kind of playing out into this kind of chaos. Obviously, there's a war going on in the Middle East that is impacting a lot more than just college sports that I think everybody in Washington is going to be focused on. There's actually the East Regional there in D.C. this year. So there's going to be a very interesting confluence of college sports and the administration there, coming together as one. And, you know, going back to, you know, there is the kind of this push and pull between the SAVE Act. There's a couple other acts in Congress that have been talked about, debated. But this just kind of goes to reaffirm my initial point. Like, nobody in college athletics can kind of agree. What is it that we desperately need? What is the bare minimum? Why are we not all just, all right, one thing. We need one thing. And that has not been the case. They're asking for too much in some cases. They're asking for too little in other cases. And this just kind of goes back to the entire strategy of trying to go to Capitol Hill, which, you know, let's face it, has been pushed by NCAA leadership. It's been pushed by the conference commissioners. It's been pushed by a lot of ADs at some point. They've all made these trips to talk with their congressmen and senators and say, hey, we need this help. And they always say, hey, we've got some traction on this. You know, we've had these hearings. We're gaining ground. But guess what? You know, it's almost midterm season. I think this is definitely completely off the radar. I don't anticipate anything getting done necessarily in terms of what the NCAA ultimately wants out of this, whether it's a limited antitrust exemption, whether it's more, which, you know, the SAVE Act and Cody Campbell have been pushing for so they can kind of pull TV rights. That's why this latest kerfuffle kind of came out. In terms of the Big Ten and SEC saying, hey, wait a minute, this is actually not that great of an idea where it's not really going to play out how you think it does. You can choose to believe who you want in terms of that debate. But it kind of goes back to the fact that nobody really understands that they're not going to get anything done in Washington, D.C. at this point. And we really haven't. There are a lot bigger issues that those folks on Capitol Hill are dealing with. There's got to be a strategy change. And I'm going to be very curious to see over these next couple of weeks, as people are crisscrossing the country, as they're seeing names and faces and commissioners and ADs and all that are coming together a little bit, will the strategy change at some point? And I'm going to be very, very curious. I'm sure we'll see Charlie Baker in Indianapolis a couple of times as well. Is the strategy at some point going to be understanding of saying this can't continue? We've got to change something in terms of what we're going to be doing, because they're not going to get the help from Washington, D.C. And I think this latest case of the Power Two conferences kind of going against everybody else in terms of saying, hey, this is not a good idea, which the Big 12 would obviously want, which Cody Campbell and Texas Tech and a number of other boosters out there that are kind of on his side would love to get. It's just not going to happen. So we will see moving forward what the ultimate strategy change ends up being. But it's got to have to happen here in the near future. And I'm going to be curious if all these events of these last couple of weeks will kind of lead to that there in Indianapolis.
It just strikes me that, like, we can't let perfect be the enemy of good here. Like, if there are truly, like, deeply pressing problems, right? Like, every statement about an eligibility lawsuit is that, like, high school sports are under attack and we can't bear the concept of losing access to these opportunities. Okay, let's go out and try to solve that problem. We don't need to solve every problem. We don't need the yes, an antitrust exemption would be in some ways the greatest thing that could happen to the NCAA, right? So would some kind of bargaining change in terms of rules. Like as far as I read it, like we can't just decide we're collective bargaining tomorrow and next week we've got a union, right? There's a lot of work that we need to be done. There's state laws that could be in play, et cetera, right? So I understand why the big asks have been the big asks, but at some point, like if your concern is eligibility and maintaining some semblance of college sports, let's go push that avenue. Let's work together on that. Let's find some common footing on a couple of these important issues and work together either in rulemaking, in Congress, wherever it is, and say, this is all we need right now. Yes, we have these bigger fish we need to fry eventually. Yes, there is this massive change potentially coming down the pipe eventually when you talk about like 2030 and media rights deals and things like that. But for now, if you actually believe we are in grave peril over the next couple of years of the institution blowing up, then let's ask for the one thing that fixes it, or the two things that fix it, or at least puts a Band-Aid over it. Because right now, I don't view the status quo as sustainable.
Yeah, I think you guys both make good points here that this shotgun blast of we've got to fix everything fixes nothing. You know, that this approach of we have seven urgent things, let's go get, no, you know what, that doesn't work. That's generally not how problems get solved, one thing at a time. So the complete lack of consensus is, I guess I should be used to it by now, but it's fatiguing, it's exhausting. You know, frankly, the Cody Campbell, you know, and the SAVAC people were really aggressive back during football season, and were, you know, the TV ads during every game. And they kind of felt like they punched themselves out a little bit, but clearly the SEC and Big Ten do not think that, because they came out with this here in February because they're concerned about what the momentum may be there in those areas. And yes, so the suspicion is the SEC and the Big Ten want to take care of the SEC and the Big Ten. And Cody Campbell just wants to get Texas Tech into one of those two conferences. Is there more to it than that? Yeah, there probably is. But the ulterior motives make everybody suspect. Congress, as Brian made clear, has no real interest in this or no ability to shoot the magic bullet that's going to fix everything. So we just feels like we are continually spinning our wheels here. And I agree that, excuse me, with Kevin, that if we could localize like one or two things and take aim at those and maybe see what would happen there, instead of going for the moonshot of the antitrust exemption, which guess what is not happening anytime soon, or the moonshot of collective bargaining. So find the other things and do what we can to address those. And then let's see if we can stop everybody from screaming and crying and stabbing each other in the back for a little while. Just a thought. All right, last thought before the last thought. Draft Combine wrapped up Sunday in Indianapolis. Many people ran and jumped, lifted, talked, etc. Give me one or two players who stood out positively or negatively. Brian, what do you got?
Well, I'm sure you jumped right back into watching combine coverage for hours on end as you got back stateside. And this is my favorite time of the year, and I'm fortunate not to go to Indianapolis, but a lot of the great crew at MMQB has a lot of great content. I watched it all. It is even wrote about that as soon as you come out of this podcast. I'm sure it'll be up on SI.com, some of the takeaways from the combine. I thought one of the big winners, Sonny Styles, the linebacker from Ohio State. Obviously, we saw it with the Super Bowl run for Seattle Seahawks and Nicky Mwamwari, kind of those chess pieces, you know, those type of guys. And, being a former safety, but he's physical to be moved up to a linebacker there at Ohio State. I mean, the testing numbers were off the charts, historic, even for somebody his size to, run a 4.46, to jump 43 inches, broad jump like he did. I think everybody was understanding that he was probably one of the top linebackers available in this draft, but those testing numbers kind of reaffirm what kind of player he is. And that was the kind of the takeaway. I mean, the track was super fast. It was the fastest combine ever, in terms of some of the groups, and you look at their 40 times, the average 40 time was best everywhere, but I think it was quarterback was the lone holdout, and that was the second fastest group of all time. So, this was a testing really and really elevated a lot of those freaks that we saw in college football that are going to the NFL. Kenyon Sadiq had a great combine as expected. I think everybody understood seeing him at Oregon, he was going to test well. His teammate Dylan Thineman was awesome in terms of running what he ran in terms of 4.35. I think Mike, two Arkansas guys I would shout out to get into it, that probably did pretty well. Mike Washington Jr., he ran a 4.33. At over 220 pounds, the tailback for the Razorbacks. I think he opens some eyes. I think everybody expected him to test pretty well. But for those NFL teams, it's one thing to say, all right, he's going to test well, coming from the scouts, coming from the college football side. But when they actually see him kind of drop those times, and then that kind of causes them to reevaluate, I think it was a great combine for Mike Washington Jr. And Taylor Green, his quarterback. I don't think in terms of some of the passing drills in the workout, he was quite as sharp as he could have been. But anytime you're going to jump like he did, run like he did, running a 4.3 at 6'6" with his frame, he's going to get guys just kind of interested in, maybe he's a developmental guy that I could be interested in, especially kind of day three in that range. We saw Jalen Milroe go to the Seahawks a couple of years ago, kind of in that same vein. Maybe we can use him. Maybe we can have some packages. I think the way he tested there in Indianapolis, he turned some heads, and he's going to kind of go down that track of being one of those kind of developmental day two, day three type of guys as well. So fascinating. Always love the combine. I think there were a lot of guys that stood out just because of it was such a fast track. We saw so many crazy jumps, and that kind of really reconfirmed that it was a great year in college football, and the talent level coming out of the college ranks nowadays is probably as high as it's ever been in terms of bigger, faster, stronger. You're seeing that at the combine.
Yeah, I was not surprised that Taylen Green was an underwear Olympics champion. The guy has always been a freak show. And you're right, especially in a draft class that it feels like there's a lot of uncertainty about the quarterbacks, especially working your way down the board. Why not take a swing? I mean, look, it hasn't worked for anybody else, but it might work for us. Why not? Taylen Green. I would also highlight Caden Proctor at Alabama. I mean, I'm just amazed by any 350 pounder that can move and run and jump like he can. A 32 inch vertical at 352 pounds is quite impressive to me.
That's why they threw him passes last year, man. Yep. Split him out and threw to him. I mean, he is a true freak. The guy that I wanted to just talk about briefly, Vanderbilt tight end Eli Stowers, who had a record-breaking 45.5-inch vertical. It was a tight end. Ran a 4.51. I don't care whether that's, Kenyon Sadiq's faster. That's fine. He also broad jumped 11'3". But the thing to remember about Stowers, he was a quarterback until October of 2023. He's not played three full seasons of tight end. He's still learning the position, and you can see his body. He's still going to have to get a little bit stronger and everything, but the physical tools, 6'4", 235, and, he's going to win a lot of those contested pass routes that tight ends end up having to run in the middle.
Campbell Award winner, too, so smart guy. He's going to pick up that playbook quickly, right?
Absolutely. No, he's got all the intangibles, I think. So I'm excited to see what he's going to be able to do. Excited to see D'Angelo Pond's vertical jump 43.5 for the Indiana cornerback. He's small. He's 5'9". So, buyer beware a little bit there, but that's one of those guys you just look at and say football player, production, tackles, blocks, punts, that sort of thing. I think there will be a place for him in the league. So, we'll see what impact the combine ends up having on actual draft picks. And we'll discuss the draft in a couple of months when we get to April. But for now, much more important story here that we're going to end with. Something of national import, I would say. The New York Post, God bless them. They've got the scoop here. In Georgia, they found a excuse me, a kid's lunch, and unzipped it, and inside he's got your Doritos and, I don't know, maybe some fruit or bread or something, I'm not sure, and a drink. As the caption says here, that is not Capri Sun. No, it is not. It is a Cutwater lemon drop martini. So that's in the kids' lunch box. 11% alcohol. That'll put some hair on your 11-year-old chest or however old this child is at school. Gentlemen, is the parent here in trouble, or is the parent just trying to get their kids ready for real life? Working the hard streets in Georgia, going in there to elementary school, you know, learning multiplication tables, diagramming sentences, whatever they do. Justice Sweeney, what's your opinion here?
Yeah, I'll give a pass because I have accidentally grabbed the wrong canned beverage once or twice. So yeah, you crack it open, you take that's not what you're looking for. I think. In fairness, I mean, as a kid, you walk into class with a lemon drop martini. I mean, that's pretty classy. Like we're not slamming, you know, Keystone Light here. This is big time stuff. So, yeah, I think for a one time mistake, it's a roll of an eye roll and a slap on the wrist for the parent, but nothing more.
Well, you know, as a designated lunch maker, you know, for both of my kids before they go to school, I can definitely understand, you know, if you, like you're saying, Kevin, you know, grabbing the wrong thing out of the fridge, you know, but you know, you hit the snooze button a little bit too long. You're kind of scrambling a little bit in the morning. Yeah. You gotta get the kids in uniform, gotta get, you know, boots and everything, got to make sure the bag's packed. And then you, oh yeah, we need to get the little lunch. I can understand the scramble and that maybe leading to some confusion. My question is, there is no way that you can confuse this can for a Capri Sun. Like that's a totally different things. Like the packaging is different. The look is different. So like, I'm going to cry foul on that part, but I totally get the kind of scramble nature to throw something in to the lunchbox. It does seem like a little bit of a sad lunch. I'm not going to lie. I think my kids would probably reject this. They would definitely eat the Doritos. I'm not sure what else is in there, but you know, Pat, to your point, that they would walk into school if they were old enough to understand what was actually in that can. You know, to say, hey, look what I got, guys. I can definitely understand that. I'm a little curious how this was caught. You know, like was the teacher walking around and just like, hey, wait a minute, you can't have that. Like, I do want a little more details on the story, though.
Always we need more details on these yes. things because we don't know the full motivations here. But maybe this is why my wife did not put me in charge of school lunches, because she was the healthy lunch Nazi. And I who knows what I would have put in there. But yeah, you know. OK, the parent teacher conference is going to be a little bit of a tough one for whoever the parental parties here. You know, to go in and say, yeah, we put the martini in there. But again, maybe this is a reflection of how bad the teachers are. You think the kid needs a little something to get through the day with this teacher. I'm not sure there. But anyway, we are not we're not the hanging judges here, certainly when it comes to this sort of thing. So you get a do-over, Georgia parent, and try not to throw the martini in there next time. We will try to have a better show next week. Thank you all for listening. Enjoy watching the basketball. Listen, rate, review, whatever you want to do with the podcast here. Please check SI.com. We're going to have just a massive ton of basketball, football, college sports content in the month ahead. So stick with us. And thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Let's be honest. Buying cannabis shouldn't be complicated, sketchy, or low quality. That's why I want to tell you about Mood.com. That's Mood.com. Mood ships federally legal cannabis straight to your door. No medical card, no hassle. And here's the kicker. The quality is better than anything you'll find at your local dispensary. Yeah, I said it. Whether you're into edibles, concentrates, flower, or just looking to explore, you'll find it all at Mood. And it's not just the variety that makes them stand out. Every product is sourced from small, American-owned family farms that care deeply about what they grow. It's cannabis you can trust. delivered discreetly and ready to elevate your mood. And because you're a listener, you get 20% off your first order. Just head to mood.com. That's mood.com to get started.
Here's something most people don't realize. Great sleep doesn't happen by accident. It starts with what you're sleeping on. That's why I switched to Sheiks. Their bedding is made from the same performance fabrics you'd find in elite athletic wear, but designed to help you sleep better. If you run hot at night, these sheets help you stay cool and dry. If you love that cozy, ridiculously soft feel, they've got that too. Comfort that stays consistent from the moment you hop into bed. And for anyone with an adjustable base, this is a game changer. Their Stay Fit corners are the best I've ever tried. No slipping, no popping off, even when the bed moves. When your days are demanding, Sheiks helps you wake up restored, not run down. Try them for yourself with their 60-night risk-free guarantee. Upgrade your sleep at Sheiks.com.